are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents, and students worldwide.
And I think researchers really need to work more closely with teachers in the future to develop their research questions, to collect data in schools that match the target audience of teachers and that they'd like to communicate their research to, and to think about when and where a program is likely to work.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Jenna and Zachary Neal, associate professors of psychology at Michigan State University. Jenna's work focuses on social networks in a public school context, whilst Zach's work centers around the methodology behind measuring, modeling, and understanding social networks. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are Jenna and Zach's research into how educators use their social networks to learn about programs and practices to adopt, how researchers can make their work more useful for teachers, and facilitating knowledge sharing between on-the-ground teachers and researchers via social networks.
Hello, everyone. This is Ross at Teacher Talk, the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Jenna Neal and Zach Neal from Michigan State University. Good morning to you both, or good afternoon?
Good morning.
Good morning for you both. So just for context, listeners, Jenna and Zach and I got connected electronically through Stuart Kimmy, after the great Teaching Toolkit was published last summer, I believe, and we've kind of conducted a kind of ongoing electronic communication, and we're here talking about you both and your own work. So can I maybe start with you, Jenna, to just introduce yourself to listeners and tell everyone what you do?
Sure. I'm Jenna Watling Neal. I am an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. And much of my work really focuses on understanding social networks in public school contexts. So some of my work has focused on understanding kids' social networks in classrooms, but I'm also really interested in teachers' social networks and how that influences what programs and practices they adopt in their classroom.
Fascinating. And Zach, to you?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Zach Neal. I'm also an associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. Most of my interests are on methodology, thinking about innovative ways that we can measure and understand and model social networks.
Really interesting. So can I ask you both maybe just to kind of jump in together? How did you get interested in this particular field of research?
So I was interested in this particular field of research. I started my work in schools in classrooms, working with kids. But as I was working with kids, kind of understanding their social networks in classrooms, I also noticed that oftentimes teachers were using practices that weren't evidence-based in the classroom. And I was sort of interested in where they were getting their information. So that led me to kind of look at teachers' research use and where they get their information when they're thinking about adopting new programs and practices in their classroom, and also where principals or administrators get their information as well.
And Zach, how did your interest emerge?
Yeah, so I come at it from a slightly different angle. You know, teachers are incredibly busy, as you know, and that makes it difficult to collect social network data from them. But we know they have social networks, they use social networks. And so I was interested in thinking about new ways that we could find out what teachers and administrators' networks look like and how they're actually using them in their practice to make decisions.
Really, really interesting. So I'm going to come back to this topic. Just for context for you both, I like to just unpick the background of people that I work with. So, Jenna, can I start with you? Could you describe your 16-year-old self? What were you like at school?
Oh, my. I was interesting as a 16-year-old. I would say at that age, I didn't really have a great sense of what I wanted to do with my life. It took me kind of going to college to be able to determine that.
Did you get your homework done on time?
I did. I was a pretty conscientious student, actually.
And how about you, Zach?
Oh, always turned my homework on time, certainly.
Excellent. And so at what point did You know, can you both maybe describe what happened at kind of university age?
Well, I sort of, as I think a lot of undergraduates do, bounced around quite a bit and started as a math major, then became a religious studies major, and then became a classics major, and finally settled on majoring in philosophy, which, as you might suspect, has a relatively limited employment market. And so I then, as a graduate student, wound up doing my PhD in sociology. For several years, did research in geography, which clearly led me to become a psychologist today.
That's a real grand tour of all the ologies, isn't it, Zach?
But I try to dabble in a little bit of each.
And how about you, Jenny, your university time of your life?
Oh, my trajectory is not quite as interesting as Zach's. I started as a psychology and sociology major as an undergraduate, and then kind of continued as a psychology PhD student. And so my trajectory was much more straightforward.
Thank you. And how have you both got on during lockdown? You know, we've all had highs and lows, I'm sure. How have you both managed generally?
Well, I mean, lockdown's been challenging here, like I think it's been everywhere. But we live in a beautiful neighborhood, so we've been able to get out and take walks, you know, to the park, the gardens on campus. So I think we've managed okay. And because so much of our research is in collaboration with each other, we've largely been able to keep that going.
Great. So you've both managed to meet all your deadlines and innovate new ideas?
Under the circumstances, I'd say we're doing okay.
Good. So let's return to the kind of social network work. You know, I want to particularly just touch on the project in a school here in the northeast of England, Shotton Hall Project. Could you tell listeners a little bit more about that project?
Yeah, so that project originated from some work we were doing actually here in Michigan at first. We have a project here in Michigan called the Michigan School Program or MySpy Project, Information Project or MySpy Project. And in that project, we were really interested in how educators make decisions about programs and practices to adopt, what information they use to make those decisions, and where that information comes from. And specifically, we were interested in how educators were using their social networks to learn about programs and to make decisions. And one of the things we were particularly interested in was whether their social networks ever included the researchers who study the programs that they were thinking about adopting in their schools and classrooms.
So, Jenna, just for teachers listening, could you just maybe help define what do you mean by a social network? Is it the kind of Twitter, Facebook space, or do you mean the physical environment?
We were more interested in advice-seeking networks. So we were interested in who they might go to for advice when they are seeking information about programs or practices. So that could be in a virtual space, but it could also be in person, in a face-to-face context.
Could you tell me maybe just, you know, the methodology, how were the teachers involved? You know, how did we kind of gather data or participate in the actual research? What was their involvement?
Yes, so in both our Michigan study, and then we did a follow-up study in the UK as well, because we were interested in whether the process looked similar in Michigan and in the UK, we used online surveys. And what we typically did is we went to a set of educators first, and we who were involved in decision-making in their schools, and we asked them, when you're thinking about programs and practices to adopt in your school, who would you go to for advice first? And they would give us the name of a person and the contact information for that person. And then we would go to that next person and ask them the same question.
Did this change according to the person's status within the school? So, you know, teacher might go to their kind of immediate line manager, perhaps maybe a middle leader might go to a senior manager. Is that the type of patterns that you saw?
Sometimes, but we also saw a lot of horizontal patterns. So we oftentimes saw that teachers might go to other teachers or colleagues in their school. And sometimes people would go outside of their school altogether.
And I'll put you in a corner maybe, Zach. What were the conclusions from the project? What do we now know?
We learned a lot of interesting things. One of the shocking things we learned is that about a third of the educators in both the U.S. and the U.K. reported that they don't ask anyone for advice when they're trying to make these decisions, that they don't use their social network contacts at all. And
what were the reasons?
There was a wide variation. We interviewed quite a few of them. Some of them said, well, I just make a decision from my gut reaction. I make a decision based on my own personal experience. And a lot of them said, I'm not sure who I would go to. They had colleagues, but they weren't sure who to ask or who would have helpful information.
That's interesting. And can I just maybe ask, maybe what were the reasons why they didn't know? Was it through experience or being new to the organization or a new teacher?
It ranged quite a bit. Some of them said, I wish there was a place that I could go, say a centralized repository where I could get information about these kinds of programs. And
sure.
It was interesting that they would say that because certainly in the US and in the UK as well, there are centralized repositories like that, but the teachers either didn't know about them or didn't find them particularly user-friendly. And so
right.
Although those kinds of resources existed, they weren't getting used.
So when was this research published? What period in time?
So in Michigan, we were working on this research between about 2015 and 2018, and then in the UK, between 2018 and 2019.
So relatively recent. So I guess with all that research, can I put you in a corner, Jen? And, you know, where are we now with the kind of findings, the research, what's happened since?
Yeah, so there are a couple things that have happened since. So we've been working on publishing some of these findings, but we've also moved into the realm of trying to understand how teacher and educator social networks affect their implementation of new programs as well. So not only where they get their information and how they adopt these programs, but do these networks actually help them implement the programs once they've adopted them? And right now we're looking at advice sharing in school buildings and whether that affects implementation practices.
It's really interesting. You'll both know that I'm an active Twitter user, and I guess my own networks, or at least my audience, has grown as a result of me seeking information. And there's a hashtag SLT chat I created in 2012 because I particularly found that I didn't have a network of school leaders to share ideas outside my own little space. So it's really interesting, you know, how teachers have moved to social networks, I suppose, to share ideas. What are your kind of general thoughts on, you know, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, teachers using those platforms professionally?
I think that can serve an incredibly important role. Certainly, it gives you a much larger platform than you would have otherwise. And, you know, whether it's via online social media like you've used, or other ways of getting to know teachers, we've found that people in your kind of position, Ross, are incredibly helpful in making sure that teachers' social networks put them in touch with the information they actually are looking for. Jenna described the sort of method that we use to understand their networks. And although many of the teachers didn't use their networks or mm-hmm. they got in touch with someone who didn't have helpful information, the best cases that we found were cases where perhaps a teacher went to a colleague and the colleague said, well, I know none of my colleagues here have the information we need, but I know Ross. And if anybody knows, Ross will know. And so I'll go to him. And maybe you don't know, but certainly you know the person who knows. And so we started to unpack this sort of 6 degrees of separation world that connects the teachers who are on the ground and need the information and the researchers who do the studies, understand how the things work. But there's this gap between those two worlds. And we found that it's people in your kind of position, whether by podcasts like this one, by Twitter, that are pulling those two worlds together, putting them in touch with each other, and sort of translating the research into forms that make sense for on-the-ground practice.
Yeah. Now, I know you guys are way ahead of me in terms of theory and stuff, and you'll know that I'm exploring Twitter social networks. I've come across the term betweenness centrality, which I think is what you're describing, Zach.
Exactly. I think if we were to map the entire UK education system network, we would expect you to be a particularly between node in the research and teaching world.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, I'm starting to get my head around all that kind of Twitter node terminology. It's very fascinating. I guess in some respects, MySpy project, Jenna, was that a kind of physical version in some respects?
Again, I think we were interested in anybody in MySpy that a teacher or educator might go to for advice. They could name somebody that they only know in a virtual space or that they might kind of listen to their podcast on Twitter. That could certainly be, a person that they would go to. As well.
And I'm just looking through both your websites as we have a chat, and I'm looking at yours, Jenna, where your research tab's got, you know, bridging research and practice, which I know is a big focus for teachers here in the UK. Can you give us just some general kind of projects that you're working on or some recommendations for teachers? How do they get across this kind of, I would describe it as a chasm in some respects, to, you know, where my head is now with academia? It's worlds removed from where I was as a teacher. So I guess what are you working on, and any advice for teachers that want to kind of start to explore, you know, proper research?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Zach mentioned, a lot of the educators in both the US and in the UK weren't using their social networks to learn about programs. And so I would say one of the easiest things they can do is just use those social networks to help find information. But that also requires some effort and strategy, and it can sometimes be intimidating to know where to start. And one of the things we found that was most successful in linking research and practice for teachers was if they talked to people outside their own setting. So oftentimes we found if teachers were talking only to other teachers in their school or maybe just their principal, that they ended up in an echo chamber, that they weren't really getting outside or new information. But the teachers that were going outside of their setting, maybe to your podcast or to other sources, those teachers were more likely to actually link to research that they could then use in their classroom.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, I think of the teachers on Twitter particularly, and then, you know, as I visit schools across the UK, you know, not every teacher turns to social media to learn more. So you always get kind of two large audiences, the teachers that rely on their own networks or their established physical network where they've always worked. And again, that kind of other group of teachers that you've just described that maybe are a bit hungry or seek more information in an online world. So I guess the question to you both is, what are we learning from this kind of physical and online network, and how does it make people a better teacher?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, we went into this work knowing that teachers already have networks. They don't need networks. What we really wanted to understand is, can we make those networks work better for getting teachers the kind of useful information that they can put to work in their schools? And we found that they can, but like Jenna mentioned, it requires a little bit of effort. The challenge is that it's easiest to get ideas from your colleagues in the building because you, at least before lockdown, saw them every day.
Sure.
but that often, you know, leads you in circles, what you might call an echo chamber. And so rethinking how we use the networks we've already got seems to be a real key to closing those gaps, to thinking about, you know, new sources of information, people that you know but haven't talked about, talked with about teaching recently, might bring in some new ideas, not just to you, but to your entire school.
Now, Zach, I'm looking on your website, and on your projects tab, you've got this interesting graphic with cities. Could you tell us more about that? It's quite an intriguing little graphic.
Yeah, so this is some of my other research has been focused on understanding how social networks form in cities and neighborhoods, and in particular, how that's related to segregation. I was especially interested in whether segregated neighborhoods form different kinds of social networks, if those social networks tend to be, say, more cohesive.
Really, really fascinating. So a question I've got for you both now, I guess given what you both know and have been researching, Jenna, is there any particular, it's a broad question, I know, but is there any particular thing you'd like to see change in at least the, you know, the education system in your part of the world?
We've been talking a lot about what teachers could do with the information from our study, but I also think there's a lot that researchers could do to make their work more useful for teachers. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we've done in our work is we've asked educators what makes research useful to them in their schools and in their practice. And there's a couple of things that make research more useful. So it's most useful for decision making when teachers can see it in use elsewhere, when it's easy to understand, and when it fits in their current practice. And I think researchers really need to work more closely with teachers in the future to develop their research questions, to mm-hmm. collect data in schools that match the target audience of teachers and that they'd like to communicate their research to, and think about when and where a program is likely to work.
Is it possible to kind of translate complicated research into a bit easier language for teachers to kind of translate, given that we know that they don't have a lot of time?
Yeah, I think researchers are actually terrible at that, right? We use a ton of jargon in our work, and it's not very accessible a lot of the times to teachers. So I think the more that we can make our work accessible, easy to understand, kind of lose that jargon.
How about you, Zach? What's that one thing you'd like to crack?
You know, I think the jargon is really the one thing I think maybe is holding back this link between research and practice. You know, for example, you just mentioned the term betweenness centrality. So that's a term you'd see in a lot of this social network research that's about teachers and ostensibly designed to help teachers get information they're looking for. But betweenness centrality doesn't exactly roll off the tongue.
No.
All that betweenness centrality is saying is you need to find a bridge, somebody like a Ross McGill that can uh-huh. connect a teacher to a researcher and help translate some of those terms so that they make sense in the context. Mm. And so, you know, finding a way to dial researchers back on their jargon and get teachers comfortable with, you know, the translation of some of these concepts, I think is key to sort of closing that gap.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. Now, you both know that teachers, I've mentioned, are busy people and workload's a big issue for teachers, I suppose, all around the world. I don't expect that that's not part of a researcher's headache also. So have you both got some good workload hacks that you can share? Jenna?
Oh, wow. I mean, I wouldn't presume that I would be able to like give teachers
maybe
advice
like
on
managing
how to manage
emails
or
mental health tips or, you know, writing a quick kind of blog or a paper.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do think that it's important to consider burnout. So I think especially with the pandemic right now, a lot of us have been putting in more hours. I mean, for teachers, trying to teach remotely has been a big issue and having to adapt to that. So I do think it's important. It can be very easy to just keep working, and but having that time to sort of reconnect concentrate on mental health is very important.
And you mentioned going out for a walk. So could you describe Michigan to my listeners? What's it like? I know it's a large place, but, you know, is it warm, cold, picturesque?
Well, most of the time it's cold, although it's just starting to warm up. So I'm looking at some daffodils outside the window now, which is unusually early for daffodils in Michigan,
which we don't normally see
till May. it's a fairly rural state. It was particularly interesting before we started our partnership with Shotton Hall. We'd never visited the northeast of England.
Right.
And it was strikingly similar to Michigan in, say, the size of the towns and the size of the schools and the geography. So you might imagine something like the northeast, but much bigger.
And maybe a little colder.
Be a little bit colder now. Zach, what are your kind of workload or mental health tips?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I'm just an academic, so I don't think I could handle the stress of a teacher's life. But I think there's such a pressure in academic research to make things more complicated. And I try to keep them as simple as possible, as simple as they can be. So when I'm designing a research study, writing a paper, keeping it simple helps keep me sane and sort of on track.
Great. Now, we've passed my 20-minute barrier, and this is where teachers start to get a bit itchy because they're either listening to this on the journey home or their kids are coming back after a kind of lunch break. So I'm going to fire some quick fire questions at you, and I'd like to maybe try and catch you out and ideally not get you to pause or hesitate. But I'll start easy and I'll be kind to begin with. But Jenna, could you tell us what project you're working on at the moment?
So I think I mentioned this earlier, but we're currently analyzing some data to understand how teachers share advice within their school building when they're implementing sort of more complex programs.
Great. Zach, what book are you reading?
Well, all my reading right now is work related. I could rattle off some fairly technical network titles, but we've certainly dug into Netflix quite a bit during the pandemic.
Well, that was actually my next question to Jenna. What's the last film you watched on Netflix?
The last film we watched Penguin Bloom, which is kind of a cute.
Oh yeah, that's a good film. Zach, can I ask how you both met?
How we met? We lived next door in the undergraduate dormitory at the University of Arizona on the dorm's sole co-ed floor.
So who's cooking dinner tonight?
Zach.
Or is it a takeaway?
I do all the cooking in this household.
Excellent. Back to Zach, what would be your top piece of advice for a teacher who wants to kind of start to explore maybe some research journals or some websites? What would you recommend?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Maybe finding a researcher that's interested in partnering with them might be a good first step. There are always researchers that are eager to collaborate and might be able to help translate some of the more jargony bits. Mm-hmm. And I think the researchers would benefit immensely from, you know, partnering with a teacher that actually has that on-the-ground experience.
Great. Jenna, what's your top tip for a teacher stroke researcher, a bit like me, who's hit a wall?
I would say don't get too bogged down in terms and methods. Simple research that's really well done is better than research that's like super complicated or hard to understand.
That's a good tip. I'm going to take that one. Thank you. What's your biggest career achievement to date, Jenna?
Oh, gosh. I think it's probably, getting tenure here at Michigan State University. And I've just loved all the research that I've been doing in schools, to be honest.
Great. Zach, what's that off-the-wall crazy job you never had?
Oh, I'm still an aspiring sommelier. I figure if I drink enough wine during lockdown, that surely I'll hone that skill at some point.
Very good. Jenna, are you a ketchup or a brown sauce girl?
Oh, I'm a ketchup girl, but I like brown sauce from time to time as well.
Okay, Zach, tea or coffee?
Oh, coffee all the time.
Okay, Jenna, who would you recommend I interview next and why?
We loved our partners at Schotten Hall, and we're very impressed with what they were doing up there. Louise Quinn, if you haven't interviewed her, would be great.
Okay, will do, yeah. Zach, if we had 48 hours together in Michigan, where would you take me? What would we eat? What would we go and see?
Well, right now we wouldn't do much of anything because most things are closed. But if you come in a few months,
that's true.
Michigan has an outstanding craft brewing scene, some really excellent microbreweries. And we, back in the day, used to enjoy visiting those. So I'd probably take you out to some of the breweries around here.
Fantastic. Jenna, what would you hope to be your legacy?
I just hope that the work that I do is ultimately useful to people. That would be my ultimate goal, to do work that's useful, that actually improves educational context in some way.
Okay, great. Zach, what would your mum say about you?
Oh.
I got you there.
Maybe
okay, let's go with that.
That might be an even better question to ask Jenna what she would say about me.
What do you hope to be your legacy, Zach?
My legacy. You're closing the podcast with some very challenging questions. I think I'm with Jenna that hopefully my My research is read by more than just a handful of researchers. Most of it gets clicked on by one or two people. I'm aiming for maybe 5 or 10, including my mom.
I've been as I get into this world, I've started to look at is it the altrametrics? You can see where people click or share, and it seems to be the social media sharing that seems to. I think it's a relatively new feature. Maybe I'm wrong, but it looks like that's where it's shared more often than others.
That's right. Yeah.
And is that? Do you think? What are your thoughts on paywalls and things that are really hard to access? Generally, I've gone a bit off piece there, but just kind of general thoughts on is research easy to access, or is it all a bit of a minefield behind paywalls?
No, that's a really good question. Actually, something we've thought about quite a bit, and we hate paywalls. And so, at least for us, we've tried to make every paper we've published available at no cost through our website. And so, all of the work that we've talked about here is available without a paywall. And certainly, and this is maybe important for teachers to know, if you hit a paywall, if you found a piece of research you're interested in and you hit a paywall, never, ever pay that fee. The researcher does not see any of that. Send the researcher an email and they would be delighted to send you a copy of the research.
That's fascinating. Well, there's a great tip there. Zach, could you give listeners maybe your website address and some kind of social media connections so they can have a chat with you?
Sure. So they can always find me on Twitter at ZPNEAL. And they can learn more about some of the work we've been talking about on the MISPI website. That's MISPI.org.
Great, thank you. And Jenna, your website?
So, the MISPI website's a great place to look at my work. But also, I have a website at JennaWNeal.com. And my Twitter account is also at JennaWNeal.
Great. So thank you so much both for your time. It's nice to kind of do a double whack together, and it's been great to connect with you properly after it's been quite a ride the last year, hasn't it?
It sure has. I hope we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel soon.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Keep up the good work, and I'll definitely be coming to you for a bit of feedback for some social network help at some shape or form in the future.
That sounds great. It's been fun chatting with you, Ross.
Yeah, it's been great chatting with you.
Thanks, guys. All the best, and thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.